Good morning. This is the Tuesday edition of Down to Brass Tacks. 4341-790, the number you call. You can reach us at 266-4862. That's our WhatsApp number. And you can send an email to brassstacks, that's one word, brassstacks, at starcomnetwork.net. John Stout is our technical operator producer. Dennis Johnson, your host. We go until 2 this afternoon with our usual breaks. For the regional roundup, we track the latest at noon. We have the network news from Flo. We should have that for you. The latest at 12:30, and then, of course, we go right through the rest of the program day. The by-election in St. George. Interesting question raised by the leader of the opposition on the question of preparedness for the by-election. I too wondered, when people said that, you know, the period for the lead-up to the by-election should be short and sharp, take advantage of persons being ill-prepared, I wondered about several things. And I've not heard anything from the Elections and Boundaries Commission, for example, because of the COVID restrictions. Will there be more or less polling stations? There were 9 polling districts, I believe, back in 2003. Don't remember the last figures, but I know those, I recall, there were 9 back then. Are the polling stations ready? Usually you have voters' lists printed, updated, checked. There are places where you can verify whether you are on the list or not. So voters are given a chance to do that. Will that be online because of COVID restrictions? Those questions came to mind. I did not know that the term for the current Elections and Boundaries Commission ended on November 1st, but that too, as the bishop suggests, will raise interesting questions about whether you have a changeover, a smooth transition, and whether everything will go according to plan. That was one side of it. The other one, however, that came up that I was a little ambivalent about is the question of debates. Having been around debates on more than one occasion, I recall this station, back when we were the Barbados Radio Fusion Service Limited, we certainly held face-offs. Let me call it that rather than calling it anything else. Organized by the head of news and public affairs, David Ellis, who is still very much with us as station manager. As far as I know, he should have a good memory. So he should be able to say whether or not they were done under the aegis of the Elections and Boundaries Commission on the directive of, or whether it was arranged by the station. But I certainly participated in several of them as the host, including a couple memorable ones I've shared with the public from time to time, one involving the then Minister of Youth, Education, Youth Affairs and Culture, now the Prime Minister, and one with Dame Billy Miller, who was then Foreign Minister. Interestingly, when I went to the Caribbean Broadcasting Corporation, they too used to have televised debates. One, there was a lot of disappointment in the way it was handled. There was a lot of crosstalk. Journalists were invited there. I think Mr. Ellis was part of that one too, where it was felt that certain people were targeted more than others. Some had more speaking time. There was rebuttal and crisscrossing, and there was general dissatisfaction with it. One of the standout ones from that one was one I've recounted on air too, again involving the Minister of Education, Youth Affairs and Culture, who came up against Tyrone Estwick. I don't even remember who the third person was, but you know, she was all over the two of them, to the point where Mr. Estwick put his arm on hers and said, calm down, calm down, calm down. And I said, oh Lord, well, you lost this one, because you don't debate somebody and put your hand on it, on them, and focus on them rather on the topic at hand. And the other one that stood out was the last set of televised debates, because I hosted that one. There was a discussion in the CBC boardroom about the type of debate it would be and the parameters. The then Prime Minister Owen Arthur did not agree with the strictures. He figured it should be freer, but they went ahead nevertheless. And I remember there was one particular debate between Dame Billy Miller and a gentleman by the name of Mr. Richard Seeley. I remember walking out of CBC and a Bajan lady of Caucasian persuasion asked, "He's the leader of the DLP?" I said, "No, he's not." And she said, "He should be." Because everyone felt that Mr. Seeley acquitted himself admirably in that particular encounter. I say all that to say this. If there's a question as to who hosts debates and how, I am sure Mrs. Medwell Smith, who was the general manager of CBC, is still very much compos mentis and alive, and as is Mr. David Ellis. So they could say whether or not those debates were on the directive of, on instructions from, or in association with the Elections and Boundaries Commission. Now, if the question is, can a prime minister and a cabinet decide to host debates, my answer is this. You can't hold a debate by yourself. So if the cabinet and the prime minister decides that there will be debates, and nobody wants to host it, and nobody wants to participate in it, you can't have a debate. What you'll have is a political speech delivered by one party. The answer to that ain't difficult. But I suppose we like to have discussions at political times about political things. But anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you. Meanwhile, life goes on. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Sir Dennis.
How are you, my friend?
I am pretty good. Now, there was some opinion of your station that you should not allow, or they're going to stop these people who soup fears or have these things about healing and something.
It's not our station, sir. The broadcast authority said don't want it on the radio.
But I can get you banned, though.
That's all right.
You know that I ain't got to come to you when I want to talk. Well, you remember when the election in St. George, was called the by-election, was actually mooted, what you said, that you believe that the election is going to run the 11th of November. You remember
I said
that?
It would be the 11th, yeah. I picked the date. What, you want lottery numbers now?
So it seems like I got to throw some coins and say you function and call for you. All right. This morning I want to deal with St. George and education. But before going to that,
you go camping.
I give you one laughter. I can get another laugh about myself.
Right.
Now, I told you that all of my relatives coming from St. George. Then it was about 6 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
It was mooted around Bob and St. George that they used to talk about a lot about heart, many heart, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you were created that thing.
Why you always do this to me?
Listen,
the cement man used to ask me the same thing. Yes, sir, I'm acquainted with what it meant. Go ahead.
Yes. Then I was there by 6, of 4 or 7. Then I didn't have a brother at the time, because I was 10 years older than my brother. My grandfather alone was at home. My grandmother gone to work, and my mother. And I decided to wander down by the factory yard. As I tell you, it is only walking distant from me. Then I get going down by the factory yard. I saw this dark lady. And those days, the old people used to wear an apron, and the head used to be tight. And she was motioning to me to come. Then I dig off and run back home. And I go home now. My grandfather's house was a house with the glass windows inside, where you could push up and put something like a nail in, hold up the glass. And then you close it, then you pull the two pieces of window from outside and shut. So I gone home, my grandfather at the window. I run straight in the house. But you know, I peep in through the window now to look to see his heart.
See you come in?
That is why they got my ex, but the woman next said, "Lord, you want to come up these steps." That is, I met a veteran straight in the bedroom. God, in those days, you got something near my heart. And boy, those big that is so expensive today. Those big bed sleds that you had it reels around the poor post that you could have put a mosquito coil on. This old lady come up the steps.
You mean a mosquito net?
Yeah. This old lady come up the steps and gone straight in the front. Oh, she had a bottle of milk in her hand. And I heard it, you know. I listened. Next thing, my grandfather called me out. So I talked to my grandfather, going to send me to this woman. But you know, eventually, it was his mother. She walked from Golden Ridge to Andrews. And those days, those old people used to walk a lot.
That's right, they were healthy.
Right. Another one, now, that at vacation time, my father would tell me that, you know, it's surprising that their children don't walk. No. I had no relatives in St. George. He would tell me that, go over to Newbury, to your family. And then if they get back home, they can ask you, you're going to look for aunt so-and-so, you're going to look for so-and-so. They know you was in Newbury. But this is the big joke now. The very man that was accused of this thing big in St. George, and calling the name. Whenever I get there, he used to tell me, you got to stop at that shop. The man had a shop. You got to speak to the man and his wife. You know how many times they tried to hide away from this man before he grew up with my great aunt. And every time I tried to hide, I could hear, Buck, come here. Buck, come here. God, it's my father in there. Buck, this is Charlie Buck.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the man that was personalized the claim to this maneuvering thing with heart. But eventually, when I get to find out, his wife was related to me. That is enough for that. So I had to.
Why you don't write the story of your experiences, man?
No, man. You know, it is an experience that I had.
But you should do it because it will add, we call it, political color and character and drama to our otherwise boring lives. Yes, sir. Go ahead. You call about something else, though. Because I'm sure that's what you call about.
I deal with education.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I always say that modern-day historians put me in the mind of a man who climbed the ladder of 60 feet. And when he get to the top, instead of walking back down the ladder, he decided to jump. So instead of getting the true history of what is happening, because history is being made every day, everybody know when he jumped to the bottom and tell you about slavery. Now, when they speak about education, I went to school at West St. George's Secondary. And you would hear parliamentarians and supporters would argue that the first people who brought about free education was the Barbados Labour Party. This is fear. And I remember very well there were four schools, West St. George that I went to, Princess Margaret, St. Leonard's and Parkinson. Unlike my school at West St. George's, it was not a new building like Princess Margaret and them. They had a new building. Old building was an old house, it's called Hill House, that was bought and the schools went in there. The children went in there. But what I am saying, that they never tell you that when these schools were being built, that the late Earl Walton Barr and Chami Tudor was part of the Barbados Labour Party.
And it's not politically expedient for them to do so.
So that is why I say that people are not being taught the truth. So the part of the development of the educational system, Elbar was part of it. Tommy Tudor was part of it. They were what you call the Young Turk.
Yeah, but sir, you see, but listen, anything with politics depends on two things. One, the reasons for enforcing them, and two, what it does to the current group of followers. What has to be appreciated, I think, with political life in Barbados is this. The period leading up to and the attainment of independence in Barbados is but a distant memory for some people and of no relevance to another set of people. And therefore, there's this wide gap between those who recall the days of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and even the early 70s, and maybe even to the mid-70s, who try to remember those days and try to embellish it sometimes or play it down, depending on which side of the fence they sat. And a group of people who were born post-1980, who have absolutely no interest in what happened prior to their birth, can make no connection between what you're talking about and what exists today, and do not see any relevance whatsoever in learning about it or about the people whose names you call. And putting it into a historical perspective, if they have neither appreciation for or desire to learn history, ain't gonna do nothing to them. They don't see it as being relevant. And that's what kills the discussion when we go down that end, because people saying, what are God doing anything?
But that is why we're in this position. One of the one of the things that I admire by Representative Cynthia Ford, when forever they talk about free education, she make no bones about it. She jumps up and tells you straight, I did not receive free education. And she is correct. Now, St. George and St. Thomas suffered vigorous, I would say, more so than anybody else in free secondary education. I remember my good friend Glenn, he was going to Federal. Majority of my uncles and things in St. George went to the modern. There were a lot of people in St. George and St. Thomas that could not afford to go to secondary school because they could not afford the payment.
Therefore,
now,
sir,
up to 1984, I moved in St. Thomas around 83, 84. Mm-hmm. And there's a school down here named Holy Innocent.
Correct.
That despite the fact that we were preaching about pre-secondary education, Holy Innocent children were still going there up to 16 years old and then finished. Those who had the wherewithal to better the life of their children, they pay for their secondary education, as St. Ford would tell you. And St. George, he had the same thing, because I met students from St. Jude's, from St. George Primary, and St. Augustine, who their teachers in those days had to write the headmaster of West St. Joseph and ask to allow two or three of their children that was finishing school and not having the opportunity to go to secondary school to accept them. And that is why I say then come to education. St. George and St. Thomas, it is only after the implementation of having St. George Secondary School that a lot of children in St. George was able to go to secondary school, but they did not have the benefit of the secondary education as the other constituencies. And that is all I would say today.
All right, sir.
I like to put things in.
Well, look, you see, and here's what I'll say to you in parting on that, right? That is why representation of the people, which is the act under which people are elected to parliament, should be important to constituents and to various parts of the island. Because if you find that the population or the people in a particular constituency or particular geographic location believe that they're being unfeared, disadvantaged because of the lack of educational opportunities, sporting facilities, other amenities in the area, that's what comes to the fore. So therefore, if St. Thomas and St. George had political representation over the years that understood this, then you would have seen, as I'm sure you have, you mentioned St. George Secondary. There is a secondary school in St. Thomas now, Lester Vaughan. And if those are not adequate enough for the population size in those constituencies or those parishes now, then there should be further representation for expansion of the educational plant. And therefore, if that is seen as something that is required in the area, that's what should be agitated. However, what has happened is that people are more concerned about national and wide-ranging issues. So those kind of what you call parochial issues may go by the sidelines. Or perhaps where the school is located is no longer important in today's environment where people got cars, and because of zoning and common entrance, people leave St. George and go to school at Queen's College or some other school, Combermere, or people leave parts of St. George and go to Lester Vaughan in St. Thomas, people leave St. Thomas and go across to Queen's College in St. James. So perhaps it doesn't matter anymore if you have schools in the particular constituency or not. But I take your point, sir. Thanks for raising them and starting us off this morning. The WhatsApp message said, I went this morning to do a regulation test at the Barbados Licensing Authority. After standing for half an hour, a man came and told me that the test was suspended. He had no idea until when, and I've already paid my money. I wasn't given another day. I have no idea when it will begin again. It's just frustrating. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Dennis. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
I just want to correct something that your caller said just now. Mm-hmm. I was bred and born. I lived in St. George. Left St. Michael's Girls School in 1963. And we had free secondary education for the latter part of my school days. And that time, the West St. George's School wasn't built yet. So I let him know free secondary education was around all that time.
Okay, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you, too. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Yay.
Yeah, I got a, how are you doing?
Hi, all right, and you?
I good. I got a phone call last night where you were on. And tell me, and Dennis on the radio tomorrow morning, you know how to say it, Rambo. He said he played some, he also played about Marty.
That must have made you very happy. Played Tosh son too.
Huh?
Played Andrew Tosh, Peter's son too.
Yeah. Why you can't
so
say
you must be
in, about you?
Must have been glee.
Yeah, you played some very good music.
I thought you would have called me about the death penalty. Go ahead.
About what?
The death penalty. I see back in the news. I know you're anti-death penalty. Sorry, you're pro-death penalty man. So I thought that's what you were called about. You called me about music. You're in a good mood.
I haven't read it yet, but I call you about something, though. I find situations and seems to be getting worse with the PSCs. Pakistan, for instance, there's a bus there by outside the Brightstown bus terminal on the main road. When you want to catch the bus, you got to.
On which side?
On
coming
the,
to town or going to
yeah,
the.
Yeah, coming to town.
Okay.
Coming to town. Where as you leave the bus terminal.
Yeah, I know where it is. I just wanted to figure out which side of the road you're talking about because there's buses on both sides.
Many buses on there during the light. The whole thereby occupied. When you are there aware of transport, but bus, you have to actually go onto the road. Now, the thing about me, Dennis, there's a police station right in the vicinity. Right there. The other day, we were going to fight from. They had this dragon thing going on. A minibus dragon and a police vehicle. Two vehicles away from that minibus. I took the number of the police vehicle to. They do anything. Now, my concern about this dragon thing, you can got somebody in that lane, and I've said this before and before and before, who have a medical emergency or any kind of emergency. But because of that person could lose their life as a medical emergency, if they're going for a job interview, do we get there late? Why is this kind of thing being tolerated? Why? You cannot have a problem going on for so many years associated with these people. Can't find solutions to it? Hello?
Sorry, listening to you. I don't know what to tell you.
The police, I guess you can see police can't tell it. Because there's four to a certain police, and you can be there doing their job, but in no time, that's in the point, and not the people back home doing the same thing again, which is true because I have a van that play the ABC role. This man been reported over and over and over again to doing the same thing. So, I don't know if it.
Look, sir, as with everything else, passing laws is one thing. Enforcement of the law is another thing. And if you have a situation where, for a number of years, practice has become the norm, other than there was supposed to be a plan to incorporate the minibuses, ZRs, into the use of the transport board's facility in Spikestone. There are buses associated with an arrangement with the transport authority. They use the transport board yard to pick up buses, the augmentation plan, or whatever it's called. If the rest depend on hustle and gathering where you can, and whether or not you're obstructing the free flow of traffic is something that anybody bothers about anymore. So those things are, especially on that route between Spikestone and Bridgetown, are well known, well documented over a number of years. And everything from racing one another at one point to driving at 5 kilometers an hour in the middle of the road so that nobody could pass on either the left or the right of the vehicle is a norm. If you travel between Spikestone and Bridgetown on a regular basis, you will know that it is the norm. So the police bring charges when they can. They get to court when it will. And people are fined. And they go back and do the same thing again. Government makes some money. The public becomes more frustrated. And we'll soon have some disruption on Highway 1 to do some infrastructural work that will make it very interesting. It's called life in Barbados, sir. That's what happens. Brass Tacks, good morning. Thanks for hearing your concerns, though. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, and you?
Listen, I was just listening to your discussion about secondary education in Barbados.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that when you think of it, you know, after about 1950, I would say 1952, do you know that there were only, outside of St. Michael, there were only two parishes that, the three northern parishes that had secondary schools. St. John in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But St. Lucie, St. Lucie had the parish school. In fact, I think all this came as a result of Michelson report in 1876 when they decided to recommend that the schools should be divided into first grade and second grade schools.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, let me do a little bit of history here. As far as in 1881, the Harrison College was given first grade status.
Mm-hmm.
And the three northern schools, the Allen School, the Corey School, and Parish School, were given second grade status. I believe the law school, which was the first grade school, was, I think that was given first grade status, I believe, around 1883. And Queen's College, I think, 1883 and so on. That lives from 1880, if I'm correct. But I didn't think that was all. But I'm trying to make a point. The law school, I don't include that because that was not open to the masses. That's why I didn't mention.
That's why I didn't mention. Okay, fine.
Right. Because mm-hmm. that was, you know, the planter, I think it was the planter's school. And the other people. Because the average person.
It was well known outside of Barbados. So people sent their children to board here and get their education over the years.
And then the school fee in those days, I mean, at $28, it's good.
It was out of the reach of some people, yes.
That's right.
If you made $100 a month, you couldn't, after you pay rent and food and things. Right. It may have been a little onerous.
So after about 1950, after the 50s, I mean, and the schools were very small too, even the ones in the north, these three, I mean, in fact, all the others were secondary, and Michael Common Mayor, which became a secondary school in 1879. Then it was obviously St. Michael's School, which was the last one, in fact, in 1928, that the last of the secondary schools to be given, that was established in 1928, and so on. In fact, interestingly enough, St. Michael is the last of the old so-called grammar schools
mm-hmm.
to be established before they set introduction of what they call the secondary modern school in 1952, with St. Leonard's and so on. But the point I'm making is that the parishes, I've asked the gentleman once who taught me at school, I asked him, how come that St. Lucie had a secondary school, St. Peter had two, because St. Peter had the core school and the Alexander School.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, you know, what was the reason for that was the people who were in the vestry at the time, who pushed for these things. The St. Lucie people in the vestry people then mm-hmm. pushed for a secondary school. And for many years they wanted to close them down, you know. There was a fight, if you go back and look at history, for many years they wanted to close down the primary school because it was very small.
Okay.
In fact, although these schools were very small, in fact, my late headmaster, who told me he attended Easter. He went there first, then when Harrison College. But he told me when he went there in 1934,
mm-hmm.
and there were only about, I think he said about 40 children. You can imagine. They were very small schools.
Yeah. So, the context in which these discussions take place, okay? Just from distant observation, if you want me to call it that, has always been more about the politics of the era as opposed to accessibility, availability, and the rationale behind them. The concept of educating the masses to lift them out of poverty is a 1950s, 1960s concept.
I agree with you. That's right. You're right.
And I don't know if, when I hear it in 2020, because I did hear it a couple of Sundays ago during the discussion with the moderator on this whole CXC mess, where I think it was a young lady from Ghana who said, after studying hard to, you know, get these grades so that we could lift our family out of their poverty, I kind of stopped and wondered how much of that is scripted and how much of that is real. Because if, for example, my children get, or don't get a scholarship, but they get good CXC grades, and they want to go to the United States, Scotland, Australia, various places to study, I would have to get a student revolving loan or some kind of loan to pay for their upkeep. If I am not in a position financially to do it, how does their achieving these grades get me out of poverty? Unless they plan to take care of me while they work. And in a lot of cases, they don't. The complaint is they don't get jobs that pay them commensurate with their qualifications once they get it. So the whole dynamic of how you link poverty alleviation with the education process, to me, has to be either rethought or some way rejigged to face the realities of 21st century. Because to me, it's just not making, it's not connecting. I can see how it worked in 1950s, 60s, and perhaps even a part of the 70s. After that, it kind of gets wobbly for me.
There's something that you said just now that is very interesting. You made the point that many of the young people, and they were born since 1980, and it's a fact, many of the younger people, they don't know anything about education. That's why I think, I wonder if it would make some sense to educate people about, you know, that should be part of your education, to know about the development of education in the country, so that children would, for instance, most people, like, they feel the common entrance exam was always around.
Correct.
The younger people. They didn't know it only started around, I think, 1959, and it came about because naturally after, in particularly around after the abolition of fees in the grammar schools, the so-called, in 1961, when the DLP came to power. In fact, the first time we didn't pay school fee was in January 62.
Right.
And what happened is that then they had limited places. This is the origin. They had limited places, and actually, and the students had to buy for the limited places. That's the origin of the Common Entrance exam, because they had limited places, and therefore, right? That's how it started. You know, they had limited places, and therefore, people had to compete them for the limited spaces in these schools. So that's it. And I think it's important that children should know that we didn't always have a Common Entrance exam.
The other thing too was that certainly in certain parts of the Caribbean where I went to school, for example, in my primary school days. Depending on how well you did in what was then called the 11 plus exam. As a matter of fact, they had two. When I was in Grenada, there was an under 12 and an under 14, so you had two bites of the cherry. If you came in the higher percentage, depending on what your grades were, government actually paid for you to go to a secondary school. Below that, your parents still had to fork out the money to send you to a secondary school. So the thought, for example, in Grenada, that an 11 plus exam meant you automatically got into a secondary school made no sense at all. When I went to live in Trinidad and Tobago now, the situation again was even more complex in that there were more children achieving the age of going into secondary school in Trinidad than there were secondary school places.
Right.
And Eric Williams had to start this junior secondary school thing to move children from primary through to secondary through this intermediate stage. And even then, the junior secondary schools were not sufficient for the size of the population. So they had two shifts, a morning shift and an afternoon shift.
Right.
And to make the matter even more complex, primary school places became even more challenging. And when I tried to explain that to people in Barbados, when I moved from Trinidad in 81, they had no idea what I was talking about. Because what I used to say to them was this: if you were married or unmarried, if you're having unprotected sex with somebody on a regular basis, and you presumed that perhaps the person will get pregnant, you registered a boy and a girl at some primary school in case the person got pregnant, and in case you had a child who would need a place in a primary school 5 years from now. And they looked at me as I was talking utter rubbish and madness. But it was a fact that there were more children than there were places available for them in primary, junior secondary, and secondary schools.
Mr. John, what you hear, there's something that I wanted to Trinidad, and I found very interesting. I remember some years ago, I was reading, long ago, I think this is when Carol Hudson Phillips was alive. I remember they were talking, in the early days of say, Dr. Williams and son, maybe after that, Queen's Royal College was the premier school. Then I remember there was a switch to the presentation colleges. They were getting all these scholarships. I think they still do it up to now. I think that's the position right now, right?
Mm-hmm. As far as I know, they're still about the top achievers.
Right. So I remember reading in the Guardian several years ago how people like Carras and Phillips and other QRC was called they were keeping a meeting to about the decline of their alma mater.
Yes, so that entire episode of, and it's the same Combe Mayor effect, if you want to call it that. There are some schools in the rest of the Caribbean that carry this prestige school thing. And when the old scholars look around and say, you know, they're not getting as many scholarships as they used to get, they're not providing as many lawyers and top echelons in this and that, you get this, you know, we need to rally around the school and see what's wrong, whether we need to expand the plant and change the plant. And then, you know, it doesn't sync, let me use that term, with what the 21st century type of education requires today. So there's this tug of war between the old images and what currently is the practice on the ground. Listen, the entire episode that has come to the fore with CXC just shows the mess that exists in our education system and why it needs an overhaul from the bottom up or from the top down, whichever way we want to start. But somehow or other, the entire structure of the education system needs an overhaul. Now, who's going to do it? What's the objective? And is it clearly articulated? Is everyone on board? Is something that can be, I don't know, it may be around for a while.
You're right, you know, because the thing about it is that what people have to recognize that education should be structured to meet the more or less the economic demands of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, I mean, and of course it's always very difficult to do it because there's this lingering thing about, and you, as you know, I mean, as you said it, there's no, I mean, throughout the Caribbean, I believe throughout the world. I mean, there's this thing attachment to schools. I believe in Jamaica, you had Jamaica College, which was the same thing happened. People like Michael Manley and all those, went and Norman Manley, the same thing. And Trinidad Williams went there, and Barrow and those went to Harrison College, the same thing. And all throughout the Caribbean and throughout the world, I believe that you can say this. But people have to recognize that the demands of the society, the demand for manpower should be critical in determining what kind of education system a country has, you know, rather than hanging on to this school type foolishness.
Correct.
I mean, which we still hang on to. But, I mean, it's very difficult to get rid of it because do not forget, Mr. Johnson, I always say that, I remember my late headmaster told me, he used to tell me that politics made certain people. families. Mm-hmm. Now, if I remember someone made a comment that Khrushchev would never get rid of communism because it made him the shepherd boy who who became head of the Soviet Union.
Union.
Mm. Now, and if people, I mean, if you look at education, particularly when the black people, it's a certain time to say perhaps, but education made them. And it is very difficult for people, let's be realistic, for people to get rid of the school tie when a fellow could turn and tell somebody, oh, he went to X school and,
oh, white school,
you know,
and
that's
go.
Right.
Correct.
And
yeah.
On
yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
It
correct.
Is difficult. It's a very difficult thing to get rid of because this is what made the people.
Yeah. And it's ingrained in their psyche. It isn't going to come out. Yeah.
And particularly the middle class Belgians, they see them and they must get at certain schools. Mm-hmm. If their children don't get at certain schools, they feel they've let them down.
Correct.
That's right. And it's a sad thing, but it is unfortunate. But it will take a long time. Finally, I want to say this to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I don't believe so much in divine intervention, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are two events recently that caused me to think about divine intervention. The same CAPE exam in relation to Barbados scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump, what's happening in the United States with Donald Trump and the COVID-19? First of all, let me do the CAPE because, first of all, the fact that we haven't heard any scholarships announced yet, and if they announce, they might be less than. I was saying, since the government has no money, that might have been divine intervention.
Mm-hmm.
The large sum of money they have to spend on scholarships every year.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, this might be fine intervention. They have saved the government
some money.
So that's right. They don't have any. Then with Donald Trump, the divine intervention brought in
the
COVID-19 to get rid of him.
It seems not to have worked. It seems not to have worked physically, but it may work politically. We will see what happens. I'll tell you one thing for sure. The intervention of COVID-19 has reshaped the landscape politically, economically, and we will see what emerges from this reshaping, because it's going to be cataclysmic. I think there's going to be a whole shaking up of the economic structure, and I don't know. We're in for an interesting ride. Let me put it that way. I'm using interesting in inverted commas. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Hello.
Hi. I was told, John told me one call. I was trying to figure out if there was someone else. Okay. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Hi.
This is Ricardo speaking on behalf of the Sanitation Service Authority.
Mm-hmm.
We're just notifying the residents in the area of Arch Hall and below, you know, who may have some concerns regarding the
smoke and
plumage that you're seeing in the air.
Mm-hmm.
We're just letting them know it's a continuous burn that we have been doing now for the last 2 weeks in order to properly dispose of the mattresses and stuff that we have here at the landfill.
Mm-hmm.
At present, we have the fire services here with us. The police is also here. So we're just letting the public know that it is a controlled burn. So there's no need for them to panic or worry or, you know, keep bombarding the stations that the landfill is burning and that sort of stuff. It's a controlled burn that is going on right now. So just to let the public know, there's no need for panic. We have everything under control.
Okay, so I sent at least two messages to persons who had sent me pictures and said landfill fire, that I'm sure it was the continued controlled burning of mattresses that has been going on for the last couple of weeks. I calmed them without going on air with it. So I'm happy that you've done so on air, and that those who may have been anxious or worried about it can now put their fears to rest. And I hope that the smoke does not affect them in any other way if they're downwind of the mangrove landfill. And thank you for doing that, sir. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Johnson. I was just calling because for the past couple of weeks, I have been trying to reach somebody from the COVID hotline, and the number is not going through. It just always goes straight to voicemail. And I've been listening to the show to see if there was an announcement for there being a new number, but I hadn't heard anything. So today I thought I would call. Just in case someone is listening and there is a new number where they can be reached, they let, you know, us know.
Okay, ma'am.
Okay,
I don't know of any number. I must tell you, I don't know of any number or any change in the number. That's all I can say. I have no idea. But if there is one and anyone knows, I hope they will help you out. Yep.
Thank you so much.
Sure, no problem. It was a WhatsApp concerning the tests for persons entering Barbados and being tested for COVID-19 and issues with receiving timely and correct responses, because the person said it was being handled and they withdrew it. But they were talking about persons having difficulty with ascertaining whether or not the second test had been positive or negative, whether they were free to go from the quarantine, etc. If we have a protocol in place where persons coming from high-risk areas are required to be tested, quarantined, and after a period of 5 days or X number of days, be tested again, and if you have two negative tests, then you're free to enjoy yourself. In other words, join your whoever you're going to join and or have a vacation or whatever you're here for. If we're having difficulties with getting back to people at the required time in a timely manner, telling them whether or not their tests have been negative, or telling them their test negative and then can't confirm it because they can't quote-unquote find the test, and people are telling them they were never tested in the first place, or you have to be tested again and go back through the whole process of being quarantined for 5 days again, it means the management of the process is being brought into disrepute. And if the management of the process is brought into disrepute, then the validity of the entire process and the ability to protect your nationals from the spread of this virus becomes compromised. Why on earth can't we get it through our skulls that it is important that when we set up systems, that we manage it in such a way that the only results, the only word of mouth being spread from person to person is a positive message. A message that says, yes, it's working, and therefore you can trust it. People, this ain't anything for us to have mixed messages about. You have questions about people being turned around at the licensing authority. You have people complaining about being unable to reach the Barbados Revenue Authority. You have to understand that media is no longer territorial, eh? It's worldwide. So you have messages going out on the World Wide Web via radio being panned across the world that your systems are not working. Your responses cannot be trusted. You can't call a place of business and get a response. It is not engendering confidence in your ability to conduct business in an efficient manner. So whether you're blacklisted, whitelisted, graylisted, or unlisted, this is not a good advertisement for how you handle business. Brass Tacks, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Yes, sir.
Let me say that your program this morning seems to be very interested, and I like the way you're carrying it on this morning. But there's a few things that I would like to say. I don't know about time. But what I find is that everything in Barbados seems to be political right. Why it is like that. People coming through the airport, some saying that they're not tested, some passing through. How come you have, according to you, what you said just now, how come you have a system set up and people can slip through? Is it invisible? What is going on? We have people that understand that this COVID-19 is a serious business. How a person can leave London tested negative come to the airport in Barbados. And when you have 100 people on a plane, two or three persons are positive. How that can happen?
Because, sir, there is the spread on the flight. What's the time it takes to fly from London to Barbados?
Well, yeah, it is 9 hours.
Okay. If during that period of time someone who's infected either uses the washroom, someone else uses the washroom, if the washrooms on the plane are not sanitized completely after use, and I'm talking about from taps to door handles to everything else they may touch on the way, if you have people who are not wearing masks during the course of the flight, take it down for whatever reason, to have something to eat or to just don't have a mask on, and somebody may cough or somebody may sneeze. Transmission in small confined places, apparently, of this virus is real, which is why there were cases on cruise ships and there are cases on airlines. Now, the protocol from Britain, which is categorized as a high-risk area, is in addition to having a test prior to leaving, if you test negative when you get to Barbados, you still have to be quarantined for a period of, I think, 5 days was the last I read, when another test is done. And if after that second test you're still negative, then you can go out. If, while you're quarantined, the second test comes back positive, then you have to be isolated for a period. Now, the challenge, therefore, is one, in quarantine, if the person is at a government facility, are they monitored? How far can they go in and around the quarantine facility? If they're quarantined at a hotel, how are they being monitored? Because people can be quarantined at a hotel at their expense. And according to the protocols, it doesn't mean that you could go around the pool and lime by the bar and generally, you know, go down the road and buy a meal and come back kind of thing. You're supposed to be confined to that place until you get the second negative result. However, if after a 5 day period, you either one, can't get a second test, two, get a second test but you don't know the result and you have to wait on the result, if you have to call to find out what the results are and you can't reach them via the phone and you can't pick up yourself and go and look and nobody's responding to you, then you don't know what to do after your 5 days in quarantine. And if after 6 days in quarantine, somebody says to you, yeah, you test negative, but we can't find the result right now, you may have to be retested, you now have an aggravated person who's being inconvenienced and who may, as some people have done, pick up and leave and go and walk out. So the whole management of this has to be understood by everybody. And by everybody, I mean the person coming in, the person who's expecting the person coming in, and there has to be regular, reliable contacts between the persons. We've received WhatsApp messages here from people who said, look, I have a 73-year-old mother who came in from country X. We are told she quarantined. Nobody at the airport wanted to tell us where. I'm in Canada and I can't find out. My sister in Barbados can't find out. What can you do? Well, we can't call anybody and ask, is Miss X or Miss Y quarantined there? Because they're not going to give us that information. It's not done that way. So the entire structure must be managed in such a way that the person who's expecting their 73-year-old mother is not becoming over-anxious, the 73-year-old person is not becoming distressed, and the person overseas is not rooting their hair out. And that, to me, is how you make sure that all parties involved are comfortable with the arrangement. So right now, that particular person I'm talking about seems unaware of whether their 73-year-old mother is quarantined at a government facility, whether she's at a hotel paying away, because there seems to be no contact with the person.
That's very unfortunate.
I think it is.
No.
I think it is.
Okay, the program is pretty short, so let me go on to my next topic, because you explained what is COVID-19 operation is all about.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you for that.
No problem.
Now, the hanging business, mm-hmm. or the There's a documentary on YouTube that there's a guy goes to prisons where there are persons to be executed, and he interview all those persons, or most of the persons who on death row. And you know, out of 99.999% of those persons on death row just are willing to be executed because of their crime. I heard a man say he deserved to be executed. How could I go in a house and kill a mother, child, father, mother, everybody? He said, he's so comfortable saying that. So when we hear people come and say they would like to be hangman or hangwoman, sometimes they can't get vexed with people, you know, because these persons that kill people don't really care anything about any person. Their mind just made up. And there's very rare that the wrong person is to be executed or hang over the case, maybe. It depends on which country you come from. Very rare. You may find a slip through, but very, very, very rare you find that the person that is being condemned or convicted to be executed or hanged, it's not guilty. Most of the time they are. And I would say that categorically. Persons must watch some of these documentaries and see when they interview the persons that do these crimes, the statements that come from them.
The interesting thing about the death penalty issue is that in most of the cases that have been found in the process of time to have been persons who were convicted on flimsy evidence or they were not guilty at all has occurred in the United States, a place that still has the death penalty and still put people to death for the committing certain crimes. It is an interesting statistic that I've picked up, but in general, I don't disagree with what you say, but sometimes people question what you see and hear in documentaries, so, you know. But
this is true. This is not the person.
I'm not saying it isn't true. You know, I'm just saying some people have no faith in documentaries. That's all I say.
But they better do, because documentaries are usually true. I don't think that you have a documentary that on a worldwide
you'll be surprised. System. You'll be surprised. That's all I'll tell you.
Okay.
I have been surprised by a lot of things in life. Including editing these days. I used to enjoy photographs at one point with the coming to being of ways in which photographs could be doctored, Photoshop and other things. I don't believe in photography and all anymore. That's the truth. That's the way life is, sir. Thanks for sharing with us, though. Interesting.